Hello, I'm Julian Morrow. Welcome to the Roundtable. On the Roundtable today, we're asking what the truck is going on with populist protests against vaccine mandates. In Canada, where more than 88% of people over five are vaccinated, a protest about vaccine mandates for truckers returning from America has captured global attention. The protest numbers in Ottawa have been small, around 8,000 people tops, but the presence of around 500 trucks and their horns has wreaked havoc, causing Justin Trudeau, the recently re-elected Liberal Prime Minister, to invoke emergency powers.
The Emergencies Act will be used to strengthen and support law enforcement agencies at all levels across the country. This is about keeping Canadians safe, protecting people's jobs, and restoring confidence in our institutions.
Similar protests have sprung up around the world under the banner of the Freedom Convoy, including in highly vaccinated Canberra. To discuss the latest bout of protests against vaccine mandates, populism, and its implications for democracies around the world, on the Roundtable today, we're joined by Dr. Josh Roos, who's a senior research fellow at Deakin University. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you.
Josh's recent research includes a project on the far right in Australia, headed Intellectuals, Masculinity and Citizenship. We're also joined by Dr. Barbara Perry, director of the Centre on Hate, Bias and Extremism at Ontario Tech University in Canada. Welcome, Dr. Perry.
Good morning.
And joining us also is Dr. Yasha Monk, the Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins University, the author of the highly regarded 2018 book about populist politics all around the world, The People versus Democracy, and also founder of Persuasion, which describes itself as a community for those who believe a free society is worth fighting for. Welcome, Yasha.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. Barbara, if we could start with you, beyond the truckers themselves, who is involved in these protests in Canada and who's the dominant force behind them, if there is one?
That's a good question. It's really quite an amorphous movement that we have here. At the outset, of course, you know, at the core of it were truckers, but the originators and the original organizers were not themselves truckers. In fact, many of the leaders are people that we've had sort of active across Canada for several years now, first with the Yellow Vest Movement and the United We Roll Convoy, which had similar, I think, uptake in some respects that revolved around job losses in the energy sector. And so the organizers actually had a, you know, fairly long and deep relationship with elements of the far right in Canada. So no mistake that they picked up, you know, other pieces of that as they went along. But added to that, you know, sort of authentic vaccine hesitant people, people who, like many of us, were just tired of not having our normal day-to-day routines, but also far right elements, conspiracy theory elements, disinformation, and in particular, an anti-statist element that has really come to the fore, I think, as this has worn on.
And Barbara, do you have a sense that anything in that very broad range of influences is sort of shaping or controlling the actions of the protesters, either at the beginning or now?
I think it really has become this anti-authority movement. The focus really is now on government overreach, what's represented as a tyrannical state, you know, a government that's out of touch. So it is at base an anti-democratic movement. And in fact, if you look at their memorandum of understanding from the outset, you know, one of their goals was to oust the current government. So very much anti-democratic.
If I could come to you, Dr. Josh Roos, you've written about the protesters on the ground in Australia, spanning a pretty similar and in some ways quirkily diverse mix of demographics. Who, in your view, is making up the protests in Canberra?
Yeah, there's remarkable parallels between what's occurring in Australia and Canada, but more broadly internationally. In Australia, I mean, there is obviously the anti-vaccine mandate protest. They like to represent themselves as mums and dads and ordinary members of the community. But the moment you actually start to look online at their message boards and you look at the composition of the crowd and what they're, you know, the banners that they're carrying and everything else, You can see there's a really diverse range of people and actors, everything from evangelical Christians through to militant wellness groups. We're talking sovereign citizens, but we also see, quite concerningly, ultra-nationalists and waving flags. We see the emergence of the Proud Boys and other far-right groups, QAnon conspiracy theorists. So again, very similar to Canada in that they are anti-state. They're inflected with a libertarian sort of language, talking about tyranny, talking about overthrowing the government very often, but also this far-right sort of discourse, again, anti-state, the need for radical change, and that the system's broken. So we're seeing populist politicians who are seeking to exploit this.
Yeah, Shimon, you've written about populism being on the rise, and that was before the pandemic. Do you think there's anything distinctive or particularly dangerous about populist sentiment focusing on the issue of vaccine mandates?
No, I wouldn't say. There's certainly something distinctive. I think in general, we've actually seen a slight abatement of populist sentiment over the last couple of years. It was relatively easy to ignore the warnings of people who said that populist politicians often don't live up to their promises, that they often don't listen to experts when it's important, that they're often not very good at governing before the pandemic, because all of those fears seemed relatively abstract. What we've seen in the last couple of years is that many people have seen the cost of bad governance, the importance of government efficiency, and that has actually somewhat decreased support for populist candidates in a number of Western European, North American, and other democracies. So I wouldn't say that the pandemic has necessarily exacerbated that. One thing that's interesting, however, is that there is sort of something about truckers being able to influence politics. It just is people who have control over vehicles which can very effectively block roads. And as a result, a relatively small number of people can actually disrupt the economy and disrupt daily life in a very significant way. It's interesting, for example, that the least popular moment of the Tony Blair government in the United Kingdom was during protests by truckers or lorry drivers, as they would have been called there, over fuel prices in the year 2000. And so I think what we're seeing here is not a growth of populist sentiment, but a section of the population that can very effectively act on its feelings in order to disrupt politics and disrupt the economy.
It's interesting that one of the themes of populism generally you've written has been majoritarianism, but in a way that sounds almost like a sort of form of minoritarianism.
Yeah, so certainly it's true that it's a minority of people in Canada, a minority of people in Australia, even a minority of people in the United States who aren't vaccinated. And so the initial impulse for these protests only applies to a minority of the population. But clearly, there is also a broader anger at government regulations during the pandemic, a broader anger at the fact that we haven't completely returned back to normal life. And that is shared by a much larger segment of the population. And we've seen in the last few years, in part because protests are more decentralized, come about in a semi-spontaneous way, often through networks of people, that the initial call to action can quickly morph into a much broader constellation of grievances. We saw that, for example, during the Gilets jaunes, the yellow vest protests in France, which were also occasioned by an increase in gas prices, but came to have a whole series of demands, a whole series of grievances about contemporary French politics, which were only loosely connected to the initial cause. So yes, absolutely, the cause of protesting against restrictions on those who are unvaccinated only applies to a minority of the population. But some of the themes that these protests speak to are certainly shared, not by a majority of the population, I would think, but by a much broader range of people.
On that note, let's hear a little audio from one of the protesters in Ottawa.
Stand up for our freedom. Stand up for our children, our future.
Yes, the rallying cry of freedom has been one of the most notable elements of the global protests. Barbara, is one of the reasons that freedom's a rallying cry because it is quite amorphous, and so it can morph in the ways that Yasha just referred to?
Yeah, it's a very fluid term. I've taken a lot of blowback for making that statement this week, actually. But it actually is a very malleable term. It's one that can be used for, in all sorts of directions. And I think that typically in the Canadian context, when we've had any kind of protests that have rallied around this notion of freedom, it's generally been amongst communities that really understand what the lack of freedom is. Racialized communities, Indigenous communities, those who have been most affected by, settler colonialism. And so for it to be sort of hijacked in this respect as a sort of not a progressive social justice term, but as a reactionary libertarian term is troubling for a country like Canada that, at our heart, in our charter, and then I think our ethos, our national ethos is liberal, pluralist societies. So that's sort of that tension, if you will, between individual rights and collective rights. And that's what's, I think, unusual about this movement in the Canadian context, and perhaps what has buffered us from seeing this sort of thing happen earlier, that we do have a stronger attachment culturally to collectivism, to, that sort of that, the social contract, if you will. And so I think that's buffered us, but that social contract is broken right now, so it would appear.
Dr. Josh Roos, freedom has also been a prominent part of the very prominent advertising of Clive Palmer's United Australia Party, trying to pick up on this sentiment. Do you think that transition that Yasha referred to of fringe claims starting to resonate more broadly with larger parts of the democratic populace is occurring in Australia?
I think there's certainly an effort to ensure that it does, in particular from the United Australia Party, who are throwing tens of millions of dollars at this. And really, Clive Palmer could be considered the Australian Trump. He's a billionaire. He's on the outer amongst sort of the mainstream, but he's seeking to exploit and to align himself with people who feel themselves to be disenfranchised, alienated and angry. The slogan for a long time was, we're not going to take it, right? So there's this paradoxical dimension of what freedom is, because he's cloaking himself in freedom. And that's an emotive term. In democracy, that's what in many ways we consider democracies to be about. But the paradox here is that freedom is freedom from having to respect and recognise others, freedom from the responsibilities of citizenship, including vaccination and so on, and freedom to do what they want, how they want. And so this is very much a minority movement at the moment, but it does potentially have and resonate at an emotional level with a deeper pocket of people who might feel themselves to have been, disenfranchised and to be angry and to feel like they've lost their jobs, that their futures have been taken away from them in the context of 2 years of COVID lockdowns and the inability to work.
Yasha Monk, you founded your own online convoy in support of freedom. As I said, Persuasion's mission is for those who believe in a free society and that it's worth fighting for. What are your thoughts on the way the rallying cry of freedom is being used in these protests and by populists more broadly?
Certainly, I, for example, think that people who invoke freedom as a reason not to get vaccinated are making a very big intellectual mistake. Mm. The vaccines are wonderful, life-saving inventions, which will allow us collectively to go back to normal life. And one of the reasons, by the way, why we should return to normal life and end a lot of pandemic restrictions relatively soon is because so many people have gotten vaccinated, and that will allow us, in fact, to deal with this pandemic much better going forward. But I think it's important when I talk about populism always to condemn some of the people who are brazenly using populist sentiments in order to concentrate power in their own hands or in order to do other despicable things, but also to have some amount of sympathy for the people who are expressing real frustrations. That is true when I talk about somebody like Donald Trump in the United States. I think it's also true when we think about something like freedom in this context. There's been a claim which has become popular very quickly among commentators and politicians to say that, all the restrictions that we had to endure during the pandemic are the real freedom that the true freedom is staying at home and not being able to go out, because that's what it takes for us to conquer this virus. And that, I think, is doing violence to words. The way that I would put it, and I was an early proponent of some social distancing measures during the pandemic, I wrote a viral article called Cancel Everything in March 2020, is that under these extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic, it is legitimate for the government to restrict some of our freedoms on a temporary basis because of this extraordinary public health emergency that we were living through. But that did entail a real restriction of our freedoms. And we need to be honest and upfront about that. And I do feel that there's something slightly Orwellian in saying, oh, you know, these people who worry about their freedom, you know, they, you know, the real freedom is to have these restrictions. The real freedom is to live up to a responsibility to society. I think the right way of putting it is that we put in place some justified temporary restrictions on our freedom. I disagree with people who believe that this is tyrannical or this was unjustified. But I'm also a little bit heartened that there are people who worry about the ways in which those restrictions might overstep the bounds, might stay on the books longer than is necessary. Because in a democracy, we want people who are hawkishly watching the government to make sure it doesn't become tyrannical. Often this is more left-wing groups that carry out this important work. I don't mind that sometimes there's right-wing groups that carry out this important work, even if I might not personally agree with many of their claims.
On the roundtable today, we're discussing the latest bout of protests against vaccine mandates, populism, and its implications for democracies around the world with Dr. Josh Roos, a senior research fellow at Deakin University, Dr. Barbara Perry, director of the Centre on Hate, Bias, and Extremism at Ontario Tech University in Canada. And the last speaker we just heard from there is Dr. Yasha Monk, associate professor at Johns Hopkins University. Barbara Perry, if I could come back to you. Now, you alluded earlier, I think, to a broader sentiment in Canada that COVID-19 restrictions do need to be rolled back. At the same time, we're now faced with the prospect of the Canadian federal government invoking emergency powers and more government coercion to deal with the protests. What is your sense of the importance of this question of government coercion and how the Canadian government's dealing with it at the moment?
I mean, I'm ambivalent at best about the Emergency Measures Act. I think it was, you know, that's a very blunt tool to be using in this context. And I think it's, you know, it's a sign of how badly the protests were managed in Ottawa specifically. I mean, law enforcement did manage to close the border blockades. I think one was after the Emergency Measures Act, but, you know, by concentrated effort in Toronto, for example, a city that has, a long and rich history of protests. They were able to manage the protests, weekend protests, quite well, you know, keeping people from congregating downtown, that sort of thing. So I think, you know, the invocation of the Emergency Measures Act is an indictment of how poorly it had been managed to this point. I think it's a step too far. There are other tools at their disposal that still haven't been used. Even, you know, especially at the border crossings, the Critical Infrastructure Defense Act, which was actually implemented more or less to manage Indigenous protest, was never invoked in this particular context, which seemed to me, an odd oversight. And I think one that really highlights the disparate response to different kinds of protests in this country. So, I think the bottom line for me is this is an indictment of poor policing to this point.
Let's move to the broader implications then for democracy and democratic institutions. I wanted to, again, call back to something Barbara said earlier. We heard the expressions anti-authority movement, but then you also said, Barbara, anti-democratic. And from Josh, we heard anti-state. Josh, do you think that there is a threat to democracy and the democratic institutions of Australia in terms of what's going on at present?
Look, I think you've got to place the protest in context, in that, you know, 95% of the Australian population are double-dosed, thereabouts. And in Canberra, where the protests are occurring, it's closer to 100%. So you could put this as an anti-vaccine mandate protest, you know, to be a small minority. But that's still, we're talking cumulatively a population of Australia, we're talking over 1 million people who have, for some reason, not gone and got vaccinated. So at this point, you could say no, it's not necessarily an immediate threat, but there is a much deeper seated anxiety, anger, sense of disenfranchisement that goes back. And this goes back generations. It ties into our economic system and its inequalities. And people are completely lacking in trust in government. Now, that's the base for any sort of populist movement and skilled populist politician to come along and seek to exploit. The major issue, though, as I see it, is that this is becoming transnational, and we need to look at what's driving it at that transnational level. Australian politician Alex Antic, for example, is appearing on Steve Bannon's podcast. We've had George Christensen appearing on InfoWars. I mean, this is a global, populist surge that's being driven, in particular, I would argue, by key actors. And I think that's got to be taken seriously, because that then becomes a broader, deeper-seated issue that governments need to take account of.
Yeah, Shamak, do you agree that the sort of transnational, globally linked aspect of populist protests and the anti-vaccine mandate movement at the moment is a particular threat?
No, I don't tend to worry too much about the transnational element. I think that exists and it can be influential in certain ways. But, you know, ever since 2015, 2016, there's been a great fear about Steve Bannon running around the world and trying to coordinate various populist movements. So far as I can tell, Steve Bannon is excellent at self-promotion and excellent at instilling fear in people, but not actually very effective as a political organizer. I think a lot of what's going on here is a form of political contagion, which is very old. You know, going back to the 1848 revolutions, you had political protests in one country which were resonant for one reason or another, then quickly being emulated in different countries. And that has now been true, for nearly 200 years. So I'm not that concerned about the linkages. I do think that there is a reservoir of anger in the population which goes beyond the pandemic, which has to do with a sense that those who are powerful don't listen to the concerns of ordinary people. Some of that is exaggerated and wrong. Some of that has a real root in reality. And I think the best way to make sure that these kinds of protests or things that are popular on social media, which may be unpleasant, don't truly become dangerous to democracy, is to ensure that those who are trying to exploit these sentiments aren't capable of winning democratic majorities. And that takes mainstream politicians very clearly condemning what is wrong in those ideas, very clearly standing up to some of these movements, but also taking seriously that decent, ordinary people can be attracted to these ideas because there are things in their lives that really do give them reason to be angry, really do give them reason to be disappointed with a political system. And so I think, yes, we have to stand up to this, but we also have to be a little bit self-critical and a little bit self-reflective about why this sort of movement can be attractive to a lot of people. If it isn't attractive to a lot of people, if a lot of ordinary people don't start to embrace it, it's not going to be a danger.
Have you been able to identify from your studies of the rise of populism in places where it has obtained a democratic majority, what it is that, or what are the red flags that sort of signal the possibility of those tipping points which can lead to genuine crisis in terms of democratic institutions?
There's a lot of different factors, some of which are economic. The stagnation of living standards over a long period of time is an important factor. Some of which are cultural. The sort of disdain that politicians sometimes express for large swaths of a population when they, make it clear that they think a significant percentage of the citizens of their own country are morally beyond the pale. That plays an important role. And the tipping point is when a lot of ordinary people start to feel, you know what, those who are in power, they're really not on our side. They really don't care about people like me. If the median voter starts to feel like that, you come to be in a lot of trouble as a political system.
Dr. Barbara Perry, Justin Trudeau did achieve a democratic majority in 2021. Do you have a sense that these protests are significantly changing that? And that, I mean, you mentioned earlier that you thought that the democratic institutions of Canada were in trouble. Do you see that as a genuine risk to democracy in Canada?
Well, I think it's important to note that he won the majority seats, but not necessarily the popular majority votes. So it was a very divisive and volatile election where we're already starting to see a very, very concentrated anti-Trudeau sentiment there. So I think that's something, it's interesting that this is sort of coalesced around a particular individual as much as the state. But I think that the pieces that feed into the anti-statism here, you know, you have to understand sort of the regional politics of Canada as well and how it played into a sense of Western alienation, for example. So much of this anti-statism, finds a particular uptick, particular strength in Western provinces, Alberta in particular, although we've seen Manitoba and Saskatchewan come to the fore as well, where they're really able to pit, you know, Central Canada, aka Ottawa, against the West. So that's certainly played a role. And then we also have to, you have to remember, you know, sort of our relationship with the United States as well, and the role that Trump has played in contributing to anti-democratic narratives, not just in the U.S., but in Canada as well. You know, the borders are quite porous anyway, and the social media borders are even more porous. So we were subject to those same Trump narratives as our American counterparts. And that has also, I think, fed into a particular hybrid of anti-statism in the Canadian context. And then you add to that, of course, because it's not just about, you know, the lack of legitimacy of the state, but also, you know, challenges to science and a lack of belief in science as an institution, and the media in particular, which has come under such incredible pressure around the world. And again, even in the Canadian context, the extent to which media were being harassed during the protests here is, I think, unseen in the Canadian context.
We're running out of time on the roundtable, so I thought we might finish up by asking all of our guests for thoughts on what works in terms of trying to contain the rise of these populist sentiments and perhaps to tone down the intensity that we've heard in the political discussion all around the world. How do we sort of pull ourselves back from the brink? Yasha Monk?
You know, I think you need to provide public order. You need to make sure that people can get to work. You need to make sure that trade can happen. But that needs to be a consistent attitude. We need to make sure that we allow a lot of freedom of protest, a lot of freedom of expression, but that consistently when people actually block roadways or intimidate people, we stand up for that. That hasn't always been the case in the last few years. And then on the substantive case, thankfully, we are now at a stage of a pandemic in many countries where I think a lot of these restrictions can actually start to fall simply because a clear majority of the population is vaccinated. We are having new treatment options, which will further reduce mortality from this virus. And so the governments around the world, including in Ontario, the biggest province in Canada, are starting to lift some of those restrictions. The cause for these protests, hopefully, will also subside. So I think in the short run, this problem, this crisis will hopefully resolve itself. In the medium and long run, politicians need to get better at listening to the grievances of people, even if they're expressed by people we might deeply disagree with, even if they're expressed by people who have some unsavory political connections, but making sure that governments actually listen to the kinds of complaints that are capable of generating real agreement among more than a small tranche of the population.
Dr. Josh Roos, hearing Yasha speak about politicians listening to the grievances of people did remind me of the debate in Australia when Pauline Hanson first rose to prominence, and how the Conservative parties tried to deal with the rise of One Nation. Is that key to sort of keeping the level of political discourse in Australia from reaching the sort of dangerous heights that we've seen in other places?
Yeah, I think it's a starting point, but I don't think it's anywhere near enough. We were already well on the way in terms of populism and, you know, the global surge, but also nationally prior to the pandemic. I'd say that it's been accelerated powerfully by the pandemic and the restrictions and loss of jobs and so on. But deep-seated inequality and economic inequality has been driving people turning to an alternative source of meaning. There was already a deep-seated distrust in politicians prior to the pandemic, again, which has been accelerated. There is already a distrust in science out there, and there was already a sort of anti-democratic sentiment in some sections of the population. So for me, I think politicians listening, I mean, that's a starting point. But, you know, unless we address, for example, meaningful work, unless we actually start as a society to have a societal level bipartisan conversation about what democracy and citizenship actually mean, then I think we're going to see the impact propounded by the pandemic over the next decade. And I'm a little bit more pessimistic in that sense.
Thanks very much, Josh. And look, unfortunately, we will have to leave it there, so I won't be able to come back to you again, Dr. Barbara Perry. But thank you so much for joining us, Barbara, on the roundtable today.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity.
That's Dr. Barbara Perry, Director of the Centre on Hate, Bias and Extremism at Ontario Tech University. Thanks also to you, Josh Roos. Great having you on the program.
Thanks so much.
Josh is Senior Research Fellow at Deakin University, and he's been researching the far right in Australia. Intellectuals, Masculinity and Citizenship is the project. And thanks also to you for being part of the roundtable, Dr. Yasha Monk.
My pleasure.
And Yasha's upcoming book, I believe it's out in April. Is that right, Yasha?
That is correct.
Is called The Great Experiment, Why Diverse Democracies Fall Apart and How They Can Endure. And as I mentioned, Yasha is also the founder of Persuasion, which also has an excellent podcast hosted by Yasha called The Good Fight. Thanks very much for joining us on the roundtable. I'm Julian Morrow.